One challenge of travel in pretty much any foreign country is that the road signs are different. Are those numerals the highway number or the speed limit? Is that speed limit in miles or kilometers? And when you see a black X inside a red and white triangle, what exactly are you supposed to do? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Of course, this kind of confusion could be an issue from one U.S. city or state to another, but we take for granted that it's not. Instead of letting every jurisdiction design its own signs, there are national standards set by something called the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's been around in one form or another since 1935, and it gets updated every decade or so. But the latest version, the draft released in the final days of the Trump administration, it has a lot of critics calling for another major overhaul now. Angie Schmidt is a writer and planning consultant and author of Right of Way, Class, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Her recent article for CityLab is headlined, Let's Throw Away These Rules of the Road. Angie, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you start by giving us a slightly more detailed understanding of the purpose of the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices?
Yeah, I mean, I think you did a pretty good job describing it. It dates back to the 40s, and the idea was no matter where you were in the country, a stop sign would look like a stop sign, a red light would mean the same thing. But over the years, it's become sort of a repository for a lot of the prevailing ideas and engineering, and it's set up, it's basically a book of standards, and it's more than 500 pages. And it dictates things like where a crosswalk can go, or where bike lanes can go, and what they look like. It's very prescriptive. And the problem is that it comes with a lot of value judgments that me and a lot of other folks in the field think are problematic.
So, what kinds of professionals would have a copy of this on their bookcase at the office?
Right. Almost only it would be engineers, and the kind of engineers, professional engineers are called, they're civil engineers that do roadway work. And so it's an industry manual for them.
So are transportation planners required to adhere to these guidelines, or are they just suggestions?
Sort of, yes. It's a little bit complex, but it is a regulation. So the process that you mentioned that's going on right now is going through the federal regulatory process. That means it's a law. And so the MUTCD, I mean, not all of the rules and restrictions in it are 100% binding. The guide does allow engineers to use engineering judgment as long as they document. So they might deviate from something the manual recommends, and they're supposed to document it. And then provided they do that, that's supposed to protect them from liability. So if someone's hurt, they don't come back to the city and sue, and then their license is in trouble.
Okay, so using this guide would be a way to kind of cover themselves.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Who's in charge of putting the manual together and updating it?
Yeah, so it's a little bit weird. It's this group called the National Committee for Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and they like to say that they're a group of volunteers. So it's a lot of professional engineers, and they're appointed by some of the important engineering institutions around the country. And then also anyone can sit in on these meetings, but the voting members are appointed by, for example, the group that represents state highway departments.
Okay, so when changes are made, is that committee of volunteers required to demonstrate evidence that those changes are safer or more effective than what existed before, or just that everybody agreed that they were a good idea?
Right. It's done by a vote. It's done by a vote. So it is very subjective. And the people who are on the committee would say, you know, we require there to be a lot of evidence to support this change. But the problem is, some people have pointed out that the rules weren't initially based on sound research necessarily. They was sort of convention or the thinking at the time that guided them.
So you note that the most recent MUTCD, this Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, was published at the end of last year and immediately criticized by multiple advocacy groups. Before we talk about their specific objections, I want to ask, is that unusual for an updated guideline to be sort of panned from the minute it's issued to the extent that people say the entire thing should be thrown out?
No, it's really unusual, and I heard from some people in the industry that they think this is entirely unprecedented. There was about 25,000 comments. So when there's a regulation, it's opened up for public comments, and they were just inundated with comments about this.
So, were there more changes prescribed in this most recent update?
The update is an improvement over the previous version, but I think a lot of people wanted to see something a little bit more dramatic. I think the engineering profession has fallen a little bit further and further behind sort of the conventional thinking that's happening in cities, and we're seeing pretty bad traffic safety outcomes right now, especially for vulnerable users like pedestrians and cyclists.
Yeah, the Governor's Highway Safety Association reported a significant increase in pedestrian auto deaths in 2020. What might some of the reasons be for that?
Right. So a lot of people think it there was so when people were not doing as much commuting, there was less traffic. We know that driving miles really decreased a lot in 2020 with the pandemic going on. But in the meantime, what happened was it opened up the streets and a lot more people were speeding and sort of taking advantage of these wide open streets. So speed is really very dangerous. It's really closely related to how often when wrecks occur, they become fatal, people are seriously injured. So an increase in speeding is one of the leading theories.
There's also been a rise in deaths among cyclists, notably bike commuters. Does the new guideline offer solutions to that problem?
So it does go a little bit further. For years, the MUTCD has restricted what kind of bike facilities can be provided. So they would only give sort of a conditional approval to the kind of bike lanes that a lot of people in cities think are the most transformative, protected bike lanes are called, that have some kind of barrier. So the new guide is a little it does approve some new bike lane designs, but it's still quite restrictive. And we worked with a group called NACTO, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, on this campaign. And they say that the new guidelines would make many of the existing bike lanes, or maybe most of the existing bike lanes in the country, non-compliant with the manual.
Wow, non-compliant in what ways?
Well, there's restrictions about when green paint can be used, for example, that don't seem to be well supported by research. So, one of the practices that's used a lot in cities is at a conflict point, for example, or just to draw visual attention to bike lanes that it's, a space for something different. They paint the pavement green. The manual is restrictive about that and some other design elements.
So, what is the consequence of that kind of retroactive noncompliance? Does that mean that those bike lanes have to be removed or retrofitted?
Not necessarily. It would sort of be up to the city's discretion. They might have their attorney sort of thinking about their liability. So some of the cities that are better resourced and more have been more progressive about transportation reform, like the Seattles and New York cities, they have sort of the capacity to navigate the additional hurdles that have been set up to this kind of more people-centric infrastructure. But where I live in Cleveland, we're a low-income city. We have a very small staff devoted to transportation issues, and they pretty much abide by the manual down to the T.
So, critics of the MUTCD contend that it's focused on the efficient movement of motor vehicles at the expense of cyclists and pedestrians. Is there some federal mandate that requires prioritizing motor vehicles, or is that simply the product of American culture?
Yeah, it's really more the latter. It's really more the latter. And it's not, and in some ways that it's sort of a bias that's hidden within the manual. And I think like I know this is a very wonky and difficult to understand, but I think one of the best examples is what the manual says about where crosswalks are allowed. So, in the United States, we penalize people for jaywalking. Sometimes people get thrown in jail for jaywalking, but the manual discourages, very strongly discourages cities from adding crosswalks with traffic signals. It says that those are only warranted if almost 100 people are crossing the street at that location per hour, which is an enormous volume of pedestrian traffic, especially where there isn't a safe crossing to begin with. So failing that, the guide says three people have to be struck over a five-year period in order for a crosswalk with a traffic signal to be warranted. And the reason for that is they don't like to slow drivers down with a stoplight. So they're sort of trading pedestrian safety to minimize delay for drivers.
That would be fine, I guess, if drivers actually paid attention to crosswalks. And my contention is just like take your foot off the accelerator when I'm trying to cross. But it feels like those white stripes, if they're not accompanied by a traffic signal, mean virtually nothing to passing motorists.
Right. We know that's true. It really depends on how fast traffic is traveling. But studies that I cited in my book said yielding rates at uncontrolled crosswalks, those are crosswalks without a traffic signal, were usually around only about 16%. So they really, you're right, they don't work very well without a traffic signal.
Some of these changes, Angie, would seem to take power away from local entities, which is the kind of thing that we are conditioned in America to really object to. I'm really surprised that municipalities don't raise more of a fuss about this.
Well, the truth is, on this campaign, I was working with this group called America Walks. We were teamed up with a bunch of different advocacy organizations around the country, including one of the leading groups is the National Association of City Transportation Officials. And they represent, I believe, more than two dozen cities around the country. They're transportation departments. They pay dues to them. They're a member organization for city transportation departments. So cities have been pretty firmly opposed to this. They want to see much more progressive changes. And the National League of Cities was sort of on board with this campaign as well. So cities do have objections that are pretty clearly stated.
Angie, I do want to refer to something from your book. And I wonder if the fact that pedestrian deaths are on the rise and we're not all up in arms about this, if that has anything to do with the fact that we associate walking places or using public transit and walking in between with poverty in this country.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct, especially in cities like Dallas, frankly, where the transit might be really minimal and the streets very dangerous. Yes. And we do see this is a problem that disproportionately affects people of color, low income people, people with disabilities, a lot of people who are a little bit marginalized.
So I have to tell you, of the things that blew my mind in your reporting on the MUTCD, the speed limit determination was number one. Can you explain how this recommends engineers set legal speed limits?
Yeah. So for a long time, the convention around setting speed limits has been this rule called the 85th percentile rule. And basically what happens is they do a speed study and they go out to a street and they measure how fast the drivers are going. And then they recommend the speed limit be set at whatever 85% of the drivers are driving below. So the top 15% craziest drivers get to sort of determine what the speed limit is.
Wow. I mean, I guess could one argue that if, you know, traffic on a roadway is moving at a certain speed, that's a kind of natural experiment that the traffic can be safe at that speed?
I mean, yes, the way we design streets is very important, and it gives drivers visual cues about what is the appropriate speed to drive. So yes, that is true. However, the 85th percentile rule, a lot of critics, including NTSB, you know, big federal agencies, say this is an inappropriate way to do things now. So in the United States, we have about 10,000 speeding-related deaths annually. It's about equal to the number of people that are killed in drunk driving-related crashes. So speeding, even though we think of it as sort of a harmless thing, is actually very dangerous. And that using the 85th percentile rule can set up a situation where the speed limit is constantly increasing. And we have very good data that shows increases in speed limits lead to more injuries and deaths, and reduced speed limits, even without changes to the street or without changes to enforcement, can reduce speeds and improve safety.
Is this another reason why, I mean, as I recall, when I was a teenager, even highway speed limits, 55 was the maximum. And now I think there are places in this country where you can go 80 or even 85.
Yeah, Texas has the highest speed limit in the country on one of its toll roads, isn't it? And it is 85. And there was some really interesting reporting a few years back, or of some research from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, that attributed thousands of additional deaths to speed limit increases on highways. It's sort of a trend in state legislatures across the country, and we can see very clearly that it leads to increased injuries and deaths. And actually, just because I at you guys, I know this is a very unpopular sort of line of thinking there in Texas, but at 85 miles per hour, so that's the speed limit, and a lot of people exceed that. Airbags don't even work properly. They're not really designed to work at that speed. And if you wreck at that speed, the force can be such that your heart would literally like explode.
So, I mean, I wonder if there's evidence that putting speed limits much higher actually gets people to their destination faster. Because on highways, I mean, one accident can throw off your commute, you know, by minutes or hours if there's a tie-up. Are faster speed limits associated with faster transit?
That's a really good question. So in cities, it does not make really a difference. So when you're doing city driving, what determines how your journey time isn't how fast you're traveling, it's how much you're stopped. So if you're really gunning it to get to the next red light in Dallas, you're just sort of wasting fuel, stressing yourself out, and it has really, really bad safety outcomes. Now, a higher speed limit on a highway on a relatively long drive can add up to something more than negligible. But it's surprising how far you have to drive before it adds up to any real time saving, almost at least an hour before it turns into minutes instead of seconds.
Okay, and when that 85% rule is being calculated, are crash rates and pedestrian accidents factored into that? Do they sort of take credit away?
Okay, sorry, one thing I want to add, I will get back to that. One thing I want to add that the time, so we have this time savings from speeding, right? Or this time savings from rushing people through lights. That's part of the MUTCD. It's what the loss of life and the loss of working years, the injury time that results from that is much more than the time savings, if that makes sense. So it's a really bad trade-off we make. Okay, and I'm sorry, your question was, do they consider, in this speed limit setting, do they consider the safety of pedestrians and cyclists?
Right.
And so they used to not do that at all, basically. It was the 85th percentile rule, and that was it. And the new guide does reduce the sort of importance of the 85th percentile rule in setting speed limits, and does recommend one potential alternative that does incorporate more of that, but it's still, safety advocates are disappointed that it's still included as part of the manual.
As I understand it, I don't know about pedestrians, but I believe in just about every place in America, cyclists are entitled to use urban roadways rather than sidewalks. Is that right, Angie?
Yes. Yeah. So, but it is, I think that is really central to this problem and the discussion is what are roads for? Who is entitled to road space? And, you know, I think in the past, before cars became the primary mode of transportation in cities, we didn't even use crosswalks. Pedestrians had sort of unrestricted, and cyclists and children who were playing had unrestricted right to the streets. And all that changed sort of in the 40s. There was a sort of an intentional lobbying campaign that introduced this idea of jaywalking. And now, now we do think of roads as primarily a space for cars.
What are the rules for cyclists who are using urban streets? They're supposed to also behave like vehicles, stopping at red lights, signaling for turns, that kind of thing, right?
Yes, for the most part, but there are, I mean, laws vary a lot state to state, and sometimes there are all kinds of weird regulations. Like Kansas City just changed its laws, but it outlawed riding a bike with dirty wheels in Kansas City.
With dirty wheels, help me understand
Yeah, just
that.
an example of there. I mean, there's a lot of laws around it.
Is there agreement that reducing pedestrian injury or death, cyclist injury or death, is as important a goal as facilitating this smooth flow of auto traffic?
Good question. So I would say, within our institutions, no. All of our institutions are set up to facilitate smooth movement of vehicles, and safety has been sort of a secondary goal or concern. But in a lot of other countries, they have sort of adopted a new approach. It's this idea called Vision Zero. And that is the idea that we shouldn't accept traffic deaths as just sort of the cost of doing business, that with better design and better policies, we can sort of engineer death and injury out of the roadways. And it's been very successful in a lot of Scandinavian countries and some Asian countries. They now have traffic death rates that are as low as a quarter of ours or even a fifth of ours.
Does it help to have a critical mass of people out there using bicycles, for instance?
Yes, absolutely. Like one of the leaders in rethinking some of these policies is New York City, where only about 50% of households have a vehicle in the household. So, and I think places like Phoenix, like we talked about earlier, where transit is very weak and the streets are very dangerous, it may be only the poorest folks, and they've been sort of unwilling at the city level to enact even the most minor changes to help protect people.
Angie, one overriding concern you have is that these new guidelines seem to assume that road users in general, whether motorists, cyclists, or pedestrians, are all uniformly paying close attention, following the rules all the time. It's certainly a reasonable thing to ask of everyone, but as you note, it's not realistic in a lot of cases.
Right. That's sort of how traffic safety has worked for a long time in the United States. If someone is hurt or killed, we sort of look for the explanation and the individual behavior. But people are not very easy to program. People behave in unpredictable ways, and people get tired, and people drink, and so there's all kinds of variables. And there's a different approach that I advocate, and a lot of people in the safety realm advocate, that's called safe systems. And that advocates for making the road system safe, whether or not everyone is fully attentive or behaves exactly the way we want them to, because we know in a lot of cases people make mistakes. So part of the responsibility lies with system designers to make the system safe.
So, what are some of the things we could do? Is it like keeping one light red a second longer when it might otherwise turn green to keep people from jumping the gun?
So one of the key things we need to do is design streets, especially where pedestrians are present, so that they control speeds a little bit better. If we can keep traffic speeds around 20 or 25 miles per hour, we can almost entirely eliminate pedestrian deaths. Almost no one hit at that speed ends up dying. So they're really great at doing this in Europe, and there's different tricks. They could use a speed hump, for example. They use bump outs at intersections, so sort of extended curbs, all kinds of little visual cues, like narrow lanes, that tell drivers, hey, this is a place where people are present, there could be conflicts, and this is a place you need to go slow.
So is it supposed to be true that if you are, traveling down a straight roadway and you're going at approximately the speed limit, you shouldn't have to stop for every red light, right?
Well, yeah, a lot of places on a long straightaway will synchronize the lights. It's definitely a best practice, and they call it the green wave, so that if you're going the speed limit, you get a bunch of greens, and if you're speeding, you get, red lights, you get caught up. Where I live, they haven't really had the resources to do that, and driving is so frustrating here. It's just random, it's all random throughout the city. But yeah, we do have, there's an expense involved and a little bit of coordination, but we do have the technology to allow that. And I think it's a good idea to do.
Is there anyone on the MUTCD committee who is looking at best practices elsewhere in the world to use those in the United States, or do we just assume that we already have things right?
So traditionally, the MUTCD, the committee as a whole, has been really resistant to adopting ideas from other countries, from Europe. Like for example, the Dutch are sort of the leaders on bike facility design, and they have a very good manual called the Crow Manual. They've sort of resisted taking any lessons from that, which I think is unfortunate. But there are reformers on the committee who are trying to hold the engineering profession account to sort of a higher standard and accountable for some of the bad safety outcomes we're seeing right now.
So, what sort of balance does there need to be between guidelines and mandates in service to safety and, considerations of how much these changes might cost the entities that are required to put them in place?
So the manual could be changed without, and in a lot of ways, without exerting an additional cost. So it doesn't mean that, for the most part, it wouldn't mean you have to go out and redo your street to comply with the manual. It just means as you go out to do your next project, you're complying with the new manual instead of the previous one, if that makes sense.
So, as you note in the piece, this most recent manual was put out at the end, the very end, kind of the waning days of the Trump administration, and many people have complained. Is there something about the Trump administration that made it worse? Is that just a coincidence? Is there any reason to believe that it would be, better under Biden or George W. Bush or Obama?
Yeah, I do think so. The Trump administration was very regulation averse and very corporate friendly, I guess. So, the new administration is a lot more attuned to urban transportation issues, just judging by who they've appointed to USDOT. So, and unfortunately, some of these issues have become a little bit partisan. So I do think we if this were written, and a lot of people are hopeful with the new administration that they will be, because this is a big opportunity. So in the United States, our traffic safety record has been eroding. We're having more people die, and we saw a really bad year last year. And even before that, our record was declining compared to our peer nations. And this is something that's entirely under the control of the administration. So Congress doesn't need to act. This is USDOT's wheelhouse and responsibility. And this would change almost every road in the country. So it's not a single project that takes a lot of work. It's sort of an across the board. We could do across the board improvements. So that's why a lot of people are excited about this and are hopeful that this new administration will sort of seize the opportunity and really sort of lift the bar.
Besides defensive driving and careful walking and cycling, do we have power as citizens to influence the way traffic guidelines are developed?
Well, we did have an opportunity to comment on this, and a lot of people are involved. I'm sure there's advocacy organizations operating there in Dallas that are pushing for local reforms, and I know there's a lot of good work happening in Houston as well. And the mayor in Houston, at least I know, is really pushing for they have a Vision Zero policy, and I think that they're trying to eliminate traffic deaths in Houston by 2030, which is very ambitious. Houston has, I believe, 400 or 500 traffic deaths a year. So If you do want to influence, yeah, I would recommend hooking up with your local advocacy groups, reaching out to your local officials to talk about what are the safety issues in your neighborhood. And hopefully, with this work we're doing at the national level, and hopefully the administration will step in, it will make it easier to do the right thing on a safety level in those parts of our communities that are important to us.
Angie Schmidt's book is called Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Her recent article for CityLab is titled Let's Throw Away These Rules of the Road. Angie, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.